Okay, good afternoon, everyone, if you are in our time zone, or good evening, good morning, depending on where you may be. I'm Francisco Ferreira, and I'm absolutely delighted to be chairing this this public event of the International Inequalities Institute here at LSE, which marks the launch of our newest research theme for the III. It's not a new research theme at the LSE, as you will soon see, but it's the new research theme within our institute on the public economics of inequality. And we have four absolute stars to present their work here with us today, and I'll introduce them in a moment. Let me just say that research themes at the III are basically the name we give to research programs that are, you know, communities of like-minded scholars, often from different disciplines, from different places, working on a particular topic. This one, the public economics of inequality, which the speakers will introduce much better than I could, is really about using new ideas and new data sources to shed light on economic inequality, to develop, to answer some old questions that we had before, which we could not answer with, but we now can with this new data. But also to answer new questions that are rising. And I want to say that, you know, when I did my PhD here at the LSE with people like Nick Stern and Frank Cowell and Tony Akison was my examiner, public economics was a very well respected and serious and important topic. But I think, I don't know what my colleagues will say, but whether they would agree or not. But I think about 15 years ago or so, 10 to 20 years ago, if you went to a mainstream Department of Economics in the United States, that was no longer necessarily the case. Public economics had faded a little bit from the front lines. Now that has completely changed again. Public economics is back as an absolute big mainstream part of economics. And this is in large part due to the people that we have here with us today, as well as to some of their colleagues that are very well known to all of you, like Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman. The four people that we have here today are part of that revolution that's bringing a new public economics to the fore. And those same people, including the four that we have here today, have not only brought public economics back into its position in the center of the discipline, but have also brought issues of inequality to the center of public economics again, as they were 30 or 40 years ago. So I'm just really delighted that they're here, that they're working with us at the III. They'll tell you more about the theme. Let me just very briefly introduce you, introduce them and pass the floor to them. So I think the order in which they'll speak is first will be Camille Landais, who is professor of economics here at LSE. He's also affiliated with STICKERD, with the Center for Economic Performance, with the CEPR, with the Institute for Fiscal Studies, with ESA, sits on the Council of the EEA. His PhD was from the Paris School of Economics. His research focuses on public finance and labor economics. And in 2016, Camille was awarded the prize of Best Young Economist of France for his research on the relationship between changes in inequality in fiscal and social policy. Dr. Xavier Jaravel, who was having a little trouble joining us, and I hope he'll join us soon, is an associate professor also here of economics at LSE. He is also affiliated with STICKERD. His PhD is in business economics from Harvard. His research focuses on innovation and productivity with related work on trade and applied econometrics. And he's also a member of the French Council of Economic Analysis. Third speaker will be Daniel Reck, an assistant professor of economics here at LSE, whose PhD in economics is from the University of Michigan. His research interests lie in the areas of public economics and behavioral economics. And in a nod to the country where he now lives, he wrote behavioral with a U in brackets in his website, which I appreciated. And last but certainly not least, our theme convener, the man of the moment, Johannes Spinnewein, is also a professor of economics here at LSE, also affiliated with Stickert, CEP, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, CPR, as well, of course, as the III. His PhD in economics is from MIT. He works on public economics, behavioral economics, contract economics, and in 2015, he was awarded the Wiley Prize in Economics from the British Academy. So a very distinguished panel. They have a lot to say. I didn't have time to tell you about all the journals they edit and things like that, but these are prominent colleagues. We're delighted to have them with us today. We'll have, the way the seminar will progress is each of them will speak for about 15 minutes. I may jump in to signal when we are getting to time, 15 minutes for each of them, and then at the hour we'll open up for Q&A. So please, you know, at that time, send us your questions, or before, if you like, send us your questions through the Q&A function, and I will help moderate the Q&A session at the end. I should say that we're very sorry that Professor Lucinda Platt, who would have joined us today as a discussant, was unable to do so for health-related reasons. She's well, but she had a little medical emergency which prevented her from joining us today. So we will miss Lucinda, but we'll move straight away without further ado to Camille, unless you want to go back to the original order. Camille, what do you say? I see that we have two Daniel Recks, so I'm assuming one of them is Javier Jaravel. Yeah, that one is Javier Jaravel. So Camille, how do you want to do this?
I'm happy to start, indeed.
And over to you.
Yeah. And so while we're putting up the slides, I just wanted to thank you very much, Chico, for this very nice introductions and very kind words. It's certainly a big pleasure for us to be with you today, and also a big pleasure for all of us to be joining more officially the III family through this new team. And what we wanted to do today was to give you a sense of what it is we are doing in the context of research on inequality, and in particular, how our focus on using new type of data, on focus on measurement, can bring new insights on the analysis of inequality. And I will start by applying this general framework, showing you how we can use new data, new measurement. I will start applying this framework to a topic that has been of interest to me over the past 10 years, which is that of gender inequality. So what I wanted to do was, first and foremost, of course, to motivate that by, you know, just reminding you how large the gender gaps in earnings, in wages, and in employment, how large these gaps persist in most developed countries, despite women having essentially closed the education gap. So today, in most developed nations, so you can think of developed nations as nations being on the right-hand side of this chart, so countries where the GDP per capita is above $35,000 or $40,000 a year. So these countries, you see, are still characterized by levels of inequalities between men and women who are very large. This gender gap of 40% means that in all of these countries, on average, women continue to have overall labor earnings that are 40% lower than that of men. And what is kind of striking is that in all these countries, actually, women are now much more educated than men. Okay. So how can that be? Well, I'm going to show you how the use of extremely rich and newly available administrative data can help us understand the persistence of such gender gaps. So first, what the new type of administrative data that we're using in our field has been able to reveal is just how large the impact of kids is, and therefore how much it matters to the persistence of gender inequality. So here what I'm showing you is the first revelation that we got from the simple use of longitudinal registry data that enables to keep track of the overall earnings history of all individuals in society over time. So we've done that, for instance, with my long-term co-author, Henry Kleven, who's also affiliated with this new team at the IAI, and Jakob Søgaard at Copenhagen University. We looked in Denmark at the overall evolution of the earnings of men relative to that of women at the moment kids arrive. And what I'm showing you here is a very simple plot where we use the richness of these data to look at the evolution of female earnings here and of male earnings here around the time of the birth of their first child, okay? But controlling for any other determinants such as age profile or cohort effects that might differ across all individuals that we see in this data. The picture is just striking. And it might seem obvious, but just seeing it this way was a revelation. As you see, men and women evolve pretty much in the same way up to the arrival of the first kid. But then suddenly you see a massive decrease in the earnings of women and they never catch up. That earnings loss that they experience at the arrival of the first child essentially persists. We show you data up to 10 years after the birth of the first child, but we also looked at, you know, up to 20 years after, there is no convergence after that. As far as men are concerned, you see that much is happening. We call this massive effect, asymmetric effect of the arrival of children on the earnings of women relative to men, the child penalty. And this child penalty is very large. It means that on average, after 10 years, women lose roughly 20% in terms of earnings relative to men because of the arrival of kids. Now, the other thing that you can do with administrative data is that you can actually also decompose the overall gender inequality that you see over time into what is driven by the arrival of kids versus other things. And this is also what we've done in the context of Denmark, and that again reveals something quite striking. Here, I show you the evolution over the last 30, 40 years of the raw gender gaps in earnings in Denmark. It has decreased and then is kind of stable around 25 to 30% in Denmark. But what you see is that the fraction of that overall gender inequality that is explained by those child penalties that I've shown you is actually very stable and extremely persistent as well. Basically, those child penalties have remained essentially the same over the past 40 years, despite women having access to much better parental leave policies, men also having access to parental leave policies, despite big discrimination fights fought in the labor market to prevent discrimination by employers against women who have kids and so on and so forth. You see, the part that is explained by kids remains extremely large. What we've been able to gain is essentially everything that has to do with the fact that men and women were different back in the days in terms of their characteristics when they enter the labor market. Women were less educated than men, did not choose the same occupation or the same majors when they went into education, that type of stuff. That we've been able to eliminate. But the thing that we cannot eliminate, it seems, is the child penalty. What that means is that today, if we want to understand the persistence and if we want to make that gender inequality decrease further, we have to understand what's going on with child penalties and try to fight the very foundations of child penalties. So now, of course, to do that, we need to understand where they come from. And again, this is where the type of data that we're using in public economics, these large administrative data sets, can help us. The first natural explanation that you hear all the time is, oh, but you know, child penalties because men and women, they are different. And in particular, there is a huge literature that is not always grounded in deep scientific arguments, but just says that, you know, because of childbearing and breastfeeding, women and men don't have the exact same advantages, comparative advantages when it comes to child rearing. So what we decided to test is whether there is any bearing to this type of explanation. And again, the beauty of the data is that we were able to match our longitudinal data sets with registries that keep track of all adoptions in the in Denmark, as well as all births. Merging this data, we were able to compare the child penalties of women who adopt versus women who have a biological child. If biology has any bearing, meaning if childbearing and breastfeeding has an impact on the behavior of women relative to men and explains part of the child penalties, then we would expect the penalty for adoptive mothers who didn't go into childbearing and who do not breastfeed to be drastically different from the child penalties that we see for mothers of biological children. Here is the result. You see that the long-run penalty of adopted versus biological mothers are virtually the same. So it's not about biology. And again, the quality of the data, the richness of the data allows us to pin that down. But we might say, oh, but it's other things such as comparative advantages. Women in general tend to have slightly lower career expectations, for instance, or slightly lower earnings just prior to having kids. And then it might make a lot of sense for women to take care of the kids in a model of specialization in the household. Is that the case? Well, again, the richness of the data allows us to test that in practice. We can look at whether the penalties for these mothers, the biological and the adoptive mothers, are drastically different based on whether they were situated at the bottom or at the top of the relative earnings distribution within their households. And you see again, no difference, virtually the same penalty. So it's not about comparative advantages either. It's not the good old kind of Ricardian idea that, you know, we have comparative advantages and that's what's driving specialization within the household. So then, if we want to go further, we really need to understand what is the root causes of child penalties. But that requires for us to change a bit that, to change focus. We need to be able to see more penalties. The problem, as I said, is that you need extremely rich administrative data to do that. So what can we do? Well, this is where new data, it's old data. When I say old data, it's not necessarily old data. It's still big data. What we've been able to do is get hold of all the exhaustive censuses for a very, very large collection of countries around the world. And the beauty is that in some of these countries, for instance, the Scandinavian countries, we also have the rich administrative data. There, we can essentially find a methodology that allows us to replicate with cross-sectional census data the type of longitudinal analysis that we can do with administrative data. And therefore, from this new methodology, this pseudo-panel methodology, measure the child penalty all across the world. And that gives us a totally new perspective. Suddenly we understand that there is actually much more variation around the world in child penalties than we anticipated. And in particular, what we discovered doing this is that there are places in the world, in particular African countries, where the child penalty is virtually non-existent. So what that essentially means is that the child penalties are potentially a much more recent phenomenon than what we saw. Trying to then correlate these child penalties and the fraction that these child penalties can explain of the overall gender gap across the path of development, this is what we found using this old data. That basically at very low level of development in these African countries, the gender gap is actually quite small, okay? But the penalty doesn't exist, the child penalty doesn't exist. As development arises, suddenly the structure of the economy changes. The structure of the economy changes, you have more salaried work and you have a separation between the work that is done in the house and outside the household. And that work is predominantly done by men. And as fertility also goes down, you have more investment in education and therefore more investment in children that drive the specialization within the couple. And this is where the child penalty happens. Then you can reduce a lot of the gender inequality by bringing more of those women to the salaried work, the high paid work, but then you don't get rid of the child penalty either. And therefore, when you reach back at high level of development, the level of gender gap that you had at low level of development, you're still essentially facing a very large child penalty. So to conclude, I think what I've tried to convey here is just how very nice granular data can bring huge insights to understand some key drivers of the persistence of gender inequality in labor market outcomes. What essentially this research agenda shows is that if we want to understand the persistence of the gender gap, we need to understand where child penalties come from. And in particular, what we are trying to reveal with this kind of new agenda is that the strong specialization of gender roles that we see between childcare made at home by women and paid salary work, mostly made outside the household and mostly devoted to men, is actually a much more recent invention in history than a lot of people might think of. So further understanding why this happened and how it can be changed is this agenda for the theme, at least for the part of the theme that is going to focus on gender inequality. And I'm very excited, therefore, to share that with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I step here.
Sorry, I don't know. I think I got muted for some reason, but over to Javier, please.
Thanks a lot for being here and the opportunity to present another part of the agenda on the link between inequality and innovation. Again, using new data to provide new evidence. And so one thing I'll emphasize in the 15 minutes we have together is also how new data can help us get a better theoretical understanding of certain phenomena. So here the dynamics of creative destruction. There's a recent body of work basically that has used new data to analyze how inequality that you see in the labor markets, inequalities in social backgrounds, how this type of inequality has an impact on the rate and the direction of creative destruction. And so there's three main channels that have been studied, and I'll give you illustrations for each of those, and then tell you how we can, we hope to go further. Great, can you hear me? Yes?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, I think the interpreter has an issue. No? Okay. If you don't tell me otherwise, I'll just continue. So sorry, the three channels are the role of market size effects in directing innovation. And so here I'll show you how income inequality can have an impact on the types of products that are introduced in the market. Number two is the channel of the choice of careers. So unequal access to careers in entrepreneurship and innovation will affect also both the rate and the direction of innovation. And then finally, very briefly, I'll tell you a bit about the role of financial incentives and topic and tax rates to induce innovation. On the first aspect, the link between market size and innovation, we can start from a simple idea and then test it using new data. So the idea is that innovation and the decision to enter a market often is led by financial incentives. And so if there is changes in the income distribution, the market size for different products will change. If you have, for example, a bigger share of income going to high income individuals, you'll have a rise in market demand for premium products, luxury products. And in turn, that creates incentives to innovate for this type of products. So more luxury innovations. And then in turn, that can have an impact on purchasing power inequality. And so this is something that we can test using new data that allows us to really draw the causal link between shifts in demands and the response of innovation and the response of prices. And so this is here a picture from a recent paper that was of mine that was published in the QJE in 2019, where I was looking at consumer packaged goods, the types of products you find in the supermarkets. And here the figure here shows a relationship between detailed product categories called product modules. Here in the x-axis, they're ranked from categories that sell more to low-income consumers to those that sell to high-income consumers. So on the left, you would have product categories like tobacco. On the right, you would have product categories like whiskey. for example. And then on the y-axis, you have a measure of the entry of new goods. So a measure of product innovation, which is the introduction of new goods in a product category. And so this is here measured as a share of spending on new products. And so you see here this positive relationship between the typical consumer income in a category and the rate of entry. And so in this paper, what I do is then show that in fact, this is a causal effect of the underlying market dynamics. Because you have more high-income consumers, here we're looking at the United States, that create incentives to introduce new types of luxury products. And then in turn, that amplifies inequality. And then this also has an impact on prices. So here I'm showing a relationship between inflation and consumer income. So it's looking at the same set of consumer packaged goods. And the graph here shows that the average inflation rate during this period was about 1.9% for households earning below $30,000, compared to only 1.1% for households earning above $100,000. So you have these large differences in inflation rates, which create purchasing power inequality. It says that there's more inflation for necessity products compared with luxury products. And in the paper, again, I link that to the underlying dynamics of innovation and market size. So this is both saying that there's an aspect of inequality that we didn't measure before, because usually we'd use a single number for inflation. And in fact, people experience different inflation rates depending on their income levels. And then in turn, I link that to inequalities in income, which induce different types of innovation. And this could be done only with this new micro data, because you see these large differences in inflation rates only when you start looking at the pretty detailed level. So one example could be, organic products versus non-organic products. So if you look at within food products, you have these very high deflation rates for organic products, but you have pretty high inflation for standard food products. So that's one example where you have strong dynamics of inflation inequality within a product category. And you don't see such big differences if you use more macro data sets, for example, looking at food as a whole compared with electronics as a whole. That doesn't yield strong differences in inflation rates across household groups. And so this study focused on consumer packaged goods, and then in ongoing work, now we're looking at other product categories, looking at other countries. This was the United States. Now we have this for 30 countries in the world, and broadly, the patterns tend to be actually quite similar. That's what you're sort of a new fact about the relationship between consumer income and inflation. And then in the paper, I'll just give you a flavor for how I draw a causal link between market size effects and inflation. So in this paper, I have a research design that first looks at the link between market size and inflation using exogenous changes in market size. And then in the second step, I apply this coefficient that draws the causal link to the changes in demand that come from shifts in the US income distribution. And if you do that, you find these large effects. So let me tell you a bit about the policy implications of this type of results. So first, this matters for the measurement of the poverty line and for eligibility and indexation of government transfers. So in the US, you have transfers like food stamps, just vouchers to buy food products that are very important. And here what we find is that food stamps have gradually lost their real value over time, because food stamps are indexed on the overall food inflation rate. And in fact, they should be indexed on the inflation for the food products that the recipients do buy. And so those are higher inflation rates. And so over the past 15 years, food stamps have lost about 20% of their real value because of these differences in inflation rates. But then more broadly, access to some support schemes, like for example, in the health, for health Medicaid, that depends on the measurement of the poverty line. And so in the case of the US, when we use corrected inflation measures, we find that there's about 3 million people that are in fact under the poverty line because they experienced higher inflation rates than we thought. And so they should have access to these support schemes like Medicaid. So this has very direct implications for millions of individuals. So in addition to these sort of very tangible implications, there are other implications that are about cost-benefit analysis. So given that here we see that when we redistribute income, we change market size, that changes the types of product we see, that means that there is an amplification effect of redistribution policies. So when we think about, say, optimal taxation, we should account for these effects. So that's one way in which we can take these insights and use them to rethink some of the policies that, we have, including models of optimal taxation. Let me tell you about a second part of the research agenda that we propose to, pursue here, which is the link between the social background of the people who become innovators and the types of innovations that they actually pursue. So there's more and more evidence that there is a link between social background and the decision to enter an inventor's career. So we've showed that in a paper looking at the US in a 2019 paper published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics. And then since then, this has been shown in, other countries. And so here, for example, there's a paper by Usha Agarwal and Patrick Gold who looked at the propensity of people who participate in a very competitive math exam, the International Mathematical Olympiads. They look at the proportion of people who then go on to do a PhD in mathematics. And here they show cross-country evidence about proportion who go into this research and science career, depending on their score in the International Mathematical Olympiads on the x-axis, and for different types of countries. So if you have low-income countries, here they're shown in blue, so systematically they are below the other curve, they go less into the research careers. So there's an aspect of this which is internationally access to science and innovation career for people from underprivileged backgrounds. So this is the international evidence, and then there's also within country evidence, so relationships between propensity to become an inventor. So here you have on the y-axis a measure of the number of patent inventors per 1,000 people. And then on the x-axis, you have parent income. So you have this very convex relationship saying that it's mostly people from with families in the top of the income distribution. So if you have very rich parents, then it's much more likely that you will become a patent inventor. And we've shown this more recently in the modern United States. If you have parents in the top 1% of the income distribution, you're 10 times more likely to become a patent inventor than if you have parents below the median income. And perhaps the most striking result here is that there's still this very big gap depending on personal background, even if you control for abilities. You know, we can use different proxies for abilities, and one important one is math test scores. So here you look at math test scores in the third grades, and you have a deviation from the mean and the x-axis. And so if you look at the right, this shows that in the blue line with dots, if your parents are not very affluent, they're below the 80th percentile of the income distribution, there's only a slight increase in the probability that you would become a patent inventor. You go from 2 to about 3. On the other hand, if your parents are above the 80th percentile, then you have this much steeper relationship, and you have a very high increase in the rate of people who become inventors. So this means that you need two things. You need affluent parents and to excel in mathematics to become an inventor in the United States today. And so that means that there's potentially a very large pool of untapped talents that could be entering these innovation careers. And so that's the main message, is that often we think about the impact of innovation on inequality, and here it's sort of doing it the other way around, saying that inequality acts as a constraint for the potential pool of innovators and number of people who could contribute to economic growth. We have many other patterns that we can, leveraging this new data, so we can see, for example, the rate of people who become innovators by detailed locations. And so this is still the United States, but it shows that depending on the city, you have differences in the rate of people who become innovators that, are about tenfold. And so that means that that's another angle. It's not just income of the parents, it's also the ecosystem in which you grow up, the types of neighborhoods that you live in, and the types of careers that you imagine yourself in. So this was a set of results about the rate of innovation. There's more and more results now about the types of innovations that people do. Some of this is about gender. One example is Josephine Cochrane, who was the inventor of the dishwasher. She got a patent for the dishwasher, and she's now in the United States Patent Office Hall of Fame of patent inventors. And so her story is that she was very well aware of how tedious the task was of, in her case, washing fine china. She was an aristocrat. Then she came up with this idea of finding a mechanical solution to solve this problem. And so we have evidence that types of innovations that people do depend very much on their background. I'll just show you one. So here is the, if you think about green patents, so patents that contribute to energy efficiency or reducing carbon emissions, it turns out that female inventors are overrepresented among the inventors of clean patents. So there's this whole other research agenda that I won't have time to go into very much, but just to say that the types of people who do become inventors have an impact on the rates, but also the types of innovations. And so this has many policy implications. And in particular, it says that giving a taste, giving exposure to innovation, giving people enthusiasm for this type of career is an important lever to increase economic growth. And this is a type of program that could be like mentorship, internships. It could be targeted to women, minorities, and people who have less exposure. And so this is an important direction for policy that we hope to develop going forward.
Just to say very quickly that you're a little bit past your 15 minutes now. So,
yes. So I think I'll stop here. Another angle that we will pursue is the role of financial incentives for creative destruction. So far, it's been mostly a theoretical work. And so we hope to bring new data to bear also on these issues. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. Sorry about interrupting you there. So I think next is Daniel, right?
Yes, indeed. So thanks very much to the to everyone who's helped to put this on. I'm going to trust everyone can see my screen now. Sorry. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong slide. I hope I didn't give anyone fits there. I'm going to talk for a bit about tax evasion and inequality and what we've been learning from some new data on tax evasion. So the broad question in this research agenda that I'm working in is how tax evasion is distributed through the income or the wealth distribution. This would be important for trying to just measure the extent of inequality. If you don't know, the sort of top 1% income shares that you will see talked about in headlines, research starting with Piketty and Saez, those are estimated based on tax return data, using the incomes that are reported on tax returns. And one component of what an economist thinks of as a person's income that's not on tax returns is the income that's unreported, so due to tax evasion. There are other components, and then there's been since Piketty and Saez's original paper, quite a bit of work to try and account for these additional components. And one of those is how to account for tax evasion. There's something of a debate about this between two divergent estimates of top 1% income shares that have been put out there for the United States. A sizable portion of that divergence in this sort of big debate about whether and by how much inequality has really risen is due to differing assumptions that these two sets of authors I've put on the slide make about how unreported income is distributed. But beyond just trying to measure inequality, it's also important to understand this broad question about the distribution of tax evasion for the question of what we ought to do about rising inequality. So it's often thought maybe we should do something to do with tax policy. We would tax high income people more. Raising tax rates is just one way to do that. You might also try and crack down on tax avoidance and tax evasion as sort of a policy tool, and the usefulness of that policy tool depends quite a bit on just how much evasion there is at the top. So to date, most studies that try and estimate the extent of tax evasion in any given country use data from random audits of tax returns. So the IRS or tax authorities in many other countries will send auditors to randomly selected individuals and audit their tax returns, and then compare what the auditors find to what was originally reported on those tax returns, and then try and get some sense of the size of underreporting of income, other types of tax evasion from doing that. And an important challenge with using random audit data for the types of questions that we're interested in is that it's difficult sometimes to detect forms of evasion that are common at the top. It's long been recognized that audits don't detect all evasion. The Internal Revenue Service accounts for this and trying to account for some undetected evasion in its tax gap studies. But this problem is likely to be especially difficult at the top of the distribution because of the complex finances of high income, high wealth individuals and the complex ways in which they earn income generating assets, the so-called pass-through ownership structures in the United States. And so my co-authors and I study this specific challenge in the US in a recent working paper. I should clarify that everything that I'm about to tell you was derived from that paper, but it's my opinion on the results of that paper and not the opinion of necessarily my co-authors and certainly not the IRS. So if you just take random audit data from the United States, quite literally, and estimate the rate at which people underreport their income by their rank in the income distribution, you get the following result, which suggests that very, very high income people do not evade. They do not underreport their income, or they evade an extremely low rate. So this is saying that about through most of the income distribution, auditors indicate that about 4% of income is underreported, maybe 5%. And then within the top 1% of the distribution, that's sort of the right side of the graph, we split the top 1% into very fine groups, you see there's just dramatic drop off in the rate of detected underreporting of income. And so if you take this picture very literally and you take the random audit data at face value, then you're led to think that very high income people do not evade. And therefore, you know, why should we bother trying to crack down on tax evasion in that group? One of the other things that we know about tax evasion from random audit data, however, is that the extent of third-party information reporting is crucial for the amount of evasion that occurs. So this is a well-known graph to people in the tax evasion literature that shows that when the IRS has a lot of information for types of income like, you know, wage and salary income, where employers who are the third party in the third-party information reporting are telling the IRS about how much everyone earns, tax evasion is almost non-existent. 1% of income is underreported. And on the other extreme, when there's almost no information reporting present for things like cash self-employment income, the estimated rate of underreporting is much, much higher. As much as half of that income can be underreported. And then there are some intermediate categories, which turn out to be very important at the top, where the IRS will have some information, for example, about someone's domestic interest or dividend income, but they won't have all of the information. And in those categories, you see intermediate rates of underreporting. And so when we take those same four categories on that graph and we look at the composition of income in the top 1%, you see that, you know, there's a sizable fraction of income at the very top of the distribution that isn't covered by systematic third-party information reporting. It's the type of income where the IRS will have a little bit of third-party information, but not enough to fully ensure that a person is compliant. And so if you take these three facts together, we have something of a puzzle, because the first graph suggests that high income people never evade. The second graph suggests that third party information is crucial for the rate of evasion. The third graph suggests that there's not very much third party information at the top of the distribution. So how are we going to resolve that puzzle? We're gonna resolve that with new data. So that new data will allow us to shed light on sophisticated forms of tax evasion that weren't being detected in the random audits. So in our paper that I'm telling, sort of mainly focusing on here, that data comes from some indications of prior non-compliance. So in response to a crackdown on offshore wealth, a large number of individuals started reporting their offshore wealth, or they participated in this offshore voluntary disclosure program, which is a little bit like an amnesty, but with heavy penalties for an amnesty. So we can see people coming into compliance, and then we know that before they came into compliance, they were evading. We can use that to learn about what the RAND audits are missing. And then also we have data on other audits of, you know, non-randomly selected individuals or audits of businesses that we can try and use as well to understand this question. So there's similar data. We're looking at the US. There's similar data that's becoming available or already available in many countries from LEAKS and other amnesty type programs. The information generated by legal proceedings where there will be a court order to a financial institution to turn over information on people that the US doesn't know the identity of, but suspects of being non-compliant, these so-called John Doe summonses. And then, you know, more recently, there have been reforms that have created data on the beneficial owners of assets. So the Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act in the US, the Common Reporting Standard of the OECD, those are generating these data on who owns offshore financial assets. There are beneficial ownership registers for other types of assets that are sort of part of the kind of evolving policy landscape here. And this is all generating data that we can use to try and understand this question. Of course, these data can often be a little bit more limited in scope than a random audit data, and they're often about a selected population. So you lose some of the benefits of random audit data, but you can at least learn a little bit about what the random audits are missing. So what we do in this paper first is we take people who, based on their behavior in the wake of the US crackdown on offshore wealth, were non-compliant, but had been subject to one of these random audits before they came into compliance. And that allows us to see, did the auditor conducting the random audit find the individual's offshore wealth? It's a rather direct test of whether offshore wealth is detected in these random audits. And what we see in the graph is that the auditors never detect that the individuals have offshore wealth. So this is the filing of a foreign bank account report is sort of the first step in complying with your reporting obligations with respect to your offshore wealth. And in fact, even in the little blue sliver of the bar where the auditor did say that the individual had some offshore wealth, usually the auditors would indicate that this person was compliant. They didn't actually detect any non-compliance even in those that tiny fraction of cases. This offshore wealth is not being found in these random audits. The individuals appearing on these lists of people coming into compliance, indicating prior non-compliance, is disproportionately people at the very, very top of the income distribution. So about 7% of the top 0.01% of the income distribution show up on one or the other of the two lists that we've constructed. I should say we've constructed these lists building on a prior paper by Niels Johannesson and Pat Langteig, Joel Slimrod, Max Risch, and myself. This also stands in contrast to the first picture I showed you, suggesting that high income people never evade. Well, they have an awful lot of hidden offshore wealth, and they're much more likely to have concealed offshore wealth than other people in the bottom 99%. Moreover, the wealth itself, the dollars of wealth are very, very concentrated at the top of the income distribution. So for the group of people who started reporting their offshore wealth, we can see how much wealth did they start reporting and how concentrated was that wealth at the top of the distribution. And we find that, you know, about 20 to 25% of the wealth belongs to the top 0.01% of the income distribution, and another 50% or so belongs to people at the rest of the top 1% of the income distribution. It's much, much more concentrated than domestically held non-hidden wealth, which is already quite concentrated, let me remind you. Wealth inequality is measured to be high even without all of this missing and intensely concentrated offshore wealth. So the implication of that is that this is going to make a significant difference for the amount of tax evasion at the top. And you may have seen, there's a prior paper on the Nordic countries that sort of shows something similar. But it turns out in the US, that's not the only limitation of the random audit data. A significant limitation as well comes from these closely held businesses, the so-called pass-through entities. So a lot of businesses in the US, especially those that are closely held, are these pass-through entities whose income is not taxed at the business level, but rather the business distributes its income to individuals where it is taxed. Or the other, it can be non-individual owners, but and we know that from other work that pass-through income is really important in understanding the rise in measured inequality in the United States. It's a very important source of income at the top of the distribution, and its importance has been growing over time. And so detecting evasion for owners of pass-through businesses would require that an auditor conducting a random audit not only audit an individual, but also audit the business that individual owns. And when you account for the fact that sometimes ownership structures can be even more complex, so that I can be a partner in a partnership, and then that partnership can be a partner in a different partnership, and so you can have these tiered ownership structures. Sometimes they go across international borders. You know, auditing situations like that can be especially resource intensive. We find empirically that business level compliance is rarely examined in the NRP random audits of individuals. But when it is, the auditors tend to find non-compliance. So only in about 3.8% of cases where a person has passed through business income does the auditor detect any underreporting at the business level. This is because they just seldom examine the business's tax return. Nevertheless, when they do so in a non-random way, they find quite a bit of underreporting. And so the implication of all of this is that these estimates that I showed you in the first figure surely are not detecting all tax evasion via pass-through business entities. Now, in the paper, we do quite a bit of work to try and understand just how much is this going to matter at the very top of the income distribution. Obviously, that is a somewhat uncertain question because we don't have broad, representative, and comprehensive data on these types of evasion. There's a little bit of uncertainty. Nevertheless, we find that it will matter quite a bit. This is just a graph showing you that just how rare it is in relative terms for business level evasion to be detected in the random audits that we're looking at in the US. So that blue sliver, that's 3.8% of business owners are found to be underreporting at the business level. There's a little bit more underreporting found for people who didn't report the income the business allocated to them, or some esoteric features of the tax code having to do with whether your involvement with a business is active or passive, which can have some tax implications. But basically, you're finding far, far less underreporting in these types of businesses than you do for businesses whose income is comprehensively examined in the NRP. That's the sole proprietors or self-employed individuals. And this income is very, very concentrated. This pass-through business income, very concentrated at the top of the distribution. And this type of income accounts for as much as a third of all income in the top 0.1% of the US income distribution. So if a third of the income at the top 0.1% is not being comprehensively examined, then we should surely be very skeptical of that drop off in the first figure that I showed you. So after our best attempt at accounting for all of these things and thinking about how much they would matter on their own for the rate of underreporting, we arrive at the following estimates, which suggest that accounting for pass-through and offshore tax evasion fully reverses, more than reverses, that drop-off within the 1% in the rate of evasion that I showed you on the first slide. And then there are additional adjustments the IRS makes for other types of undetected underreporting. When you account for those, then you end up with as much as 18 to 20% of all income in the top 1% being underreported. So what does all of this mean for inequality? So if you took the random audit data seriously and just said, took the random audit data at face value and assumed that they detected everything, then you would find that accounting for underreported income would decrease as measures of inequality, like the top 1% income share, would decrease that share by about half a percentage point. Relative to its kind of baseline level from reported incomes of about 20% of all income belonging to the top 1%. And then from a policy perspective, if we took the random audit data at face value, we would think, well, high income individuals rarely evade. So there should be a little fiscal return to cracking down on top end evasion. And if you want to fight inequality with tax policy, you're going to have to do it with tax rates or cracking down on legal avoidance. Still, after accounting for the types of evasion that we find are not being detected in these random audits, then accounting for underreporting of income and correcting top 1% income shares, we would be increasing the top 1% income share. So in other words, we would end up thinking that inequality is worse than you would have thought from an estimate based on tax return incomes alone, by perhaps 0.7 or as much as 1.5 percentage points. In this case, if high income individuals are evading as much or more than others elsewhere in the distribution, then we might think that there is a sizable potential return to cracking down on tax evasion in these groups. Now, of course, which policies would meaningfully make a dent in that problem and would reduce evasion by these individuals? In the paper that I'm mainly talking about here, we don't take a strong stab at that question, but that is very much a part of the kind of ongoing research agenda about tax evasion. So how much will policies like the Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act or the OECD's Common Reporting Standards, both of which greatly increase the information available to tax authorities to enforce taxes on high income individuals, like how much of a dent will those things make? That's a question that I and others are actively working on. And so as this research agenda progresses, and now that it's great, that's part of the III, I hope to be able to tell you all more about that in the future. So thanks very much for having me and for listening, everyone.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks very much. Johannes, we'll turn to you now, and you can discuss the size of the Lagrange multiplier with your co-panelists later, but as the budget constraint was violated a little bit, you get 11 minutes as the residual claimant. Is that all right?
That's fine. Yeah, I have to reoptimize that a little bit. Let me think how I'll do that, but I'll do so as we proceed, as we go on the flight. So feel free to interrupt that, Chico, because I'll go over. So you have to stop me. So you're seeing my slides nice and clearly. Okay, so I'm moving on to a very different topic, which is thinking about health inequalities. And again, the same team trying to tell you what we think are new insights we can gain and we're hoping to gain from newly available administrative data here. So what's the motivation here? Well, the motivation is that inequalities in health outcomes are just very substantive, even in countries where we have well-developed social safety nets, where we have universal healthcare and so on. We see very big differences in health outcomes for people with low income relative to people with high income. And these inequalities have also been very persistent, despite the fact that we really have had repeated policy intentions to try to close the gap. So we've had reports and initiatives by the World Health Organization that have been very important and influential and have been picked up by national governments as well, for instance, by the UK trying to close the gap. But unfortunately, despite all of the intentions, the gap has remained very large. From a research perspective, there is also an abundance of research done on this topic, coming from very, very different disciplines, going from public health to medicine to social policy to economics as well. But I think it's fair to say that our understanding of its determinants and really the magnitudes of these different determinants is still quite limited. And to quote Angus Deaton on this, he says, look, there is no general agreement about its causes. And what apparent agreement there is sometimes better supported by repeated assertion than by solid evidence. Okay. So let me start by setting the stage here. And setting the stage is just to illustrate how big this health gap is. So on this chart, I'm showing you the income gradient in life expectancy in the US from an influential paper by Chetty and Cotters in JAMA in 2016. And what we see here is looking at life expectancies at the bottom of the income distribution, comparing them to life expectancies at the top of the income distribution, we see like very, very big gaps For instance, for men, we see differences of 15 years of life expectancy moving all the way from the bottom to the top decile. These inequalities don't just exist in the US, where we don't have a universal healthcare system. They also exist in, for instance, a country like the Netherlands. Okay, so this is based on some own calculations, what we've did, that we've done. And what we see is that the magnitudes, in fact, going from the bottom percentiles all the way to the top percentiles in terms of the differences in life expectancy seem to be almost as big in a country like the Netherlands. Okay, so health gaps are large also in Europe, and health gaps also remain large during the pandemic. Okay, at the start of the pandemic, people have conjectured that the pandemic could be a great equalizer, for instance, in terms of health outcomes. But what we see in the data is that this has not been the case. So here I'm showing you some evidence from in Belgium, where we're looking at the mortality rates in the first wave of the pandemic in Belgium among people who are older than 65 years old. And we're linking these mortality rates to individuals' income. And so we do so during the pandemic year, and we're comparing the mortality rates to the mortality rates in the years prior to the pandemic. Okay, so what do we see if we, for instance, look at the bottom income decile? We see larger increases in the mortality rate than if we, for instance, look at the top income decile. Okay, so this has not been a great equalizer because mortality rates have been larger at the bottom than at the top. Of course, if we look at this in relative terms, then we see that the inequality has remained as large during the pandemic as it was before, and it's just that the inequality was so large to begin with. Okay, so we have strong gradients in health outcomes, linked to, for instance, income or other socioeconomic characteristics, and that of course has been well documented, and we know a lot about this from prior work. But in prior work, we see a little bit of a divide between, on the one hand, very general patterns, and on the other hand, evidence on very specific conditions. And a lot of this divide, I think, comes from the data that we have available. So let me try to clarify that a little bit. For instance, using health surveys, we can document a lot of these socioeconomic gradients because these relationships are so strong. But we cannot move much beyond these socioeconomic gradients and think a lot about what are the mediating factors, what are the biggest contributing factors, because health surveys are often not sufficiently powerful to do so. On the other hand, we have had a lot of specific studies focusing on specific health conditions, for instance, thinking about lung cancer, and then we're using health records in a very in a cohort study where we follow people who have had lung cancer at some point, and we can show how there are differences in incidence across different income groups, how there are differences in treatment, how there are differences in survival, and so on. But this is focusing on very specific cases. Also, the work done by economics in recent work has been focusing on very specific quasi-experiments that allow us to identify health shocks or economic shocks and show the impact on economic outcomes or health outcomes, but again, using very specific experiments. And there is a gap between how big the general, differences are and how much these specific conditions that we've characterized are contributing to these general patterns. So here the hope is that new data can help us closing this wedge. New data that allows us to link information from different administrative registers that at the same time are providing very detailed information, but also very comprehensive information, allowing us to link information for different individuals, but also do this for all the individuals in a given country. So this is possible in Scandinavian countries or also in the Netherlands, for which I'll show you two illustrations. So what we have available in this day in these countries is very rich data on health coming from patient records, hospital diagnosis, healthcare expenditures, health insurance choices, and so on the one hand. But we also have very rich data on different dimensions of socioeconomic characteristics, be it income, be it people's assets, their employment, their education, and all of that information we also have available for individuals' peers, the people in individuals' networks, be it in the neighborhood, in the firm they're working, or in their family. Okay. And so we're hoping to leverage these opportunities to learn more about mechanisms and think about how important different mechanisms are in explaining the general patterns. Okay. Let me provide, if there's time, two quick illustrations. One illustration that is using the universe of Dutch hospitalizations. This is ongoing work where we're trying to shed light on the role of healthcare and differences in access or take-up of healthcare and explaining how that can affect differences in health outcomes along the income distribution, for instance. And a second illustration using choices done by individuals and the quality of those choices and how the quality of those choices differs across the income distribution. And that should shed light on the role of people's health behaviors. People's health behaviors are very different along the income distribution, but we're showing evidence that some of these behaviors may be driven not by different preferences, but just by underlying behavioral biases that are more present at the lower end of the income distribution relative to the high end of the income distribution. So in the interest of time, I may skip the second illustration. Let's see where I get, but let me spend a little bit of time on the first illustration. I showed you already differences in mortality across the income distribution. Most deaths are happening through a hospitalization. So one thing we could do is look at the incidence of those hospitalizations and then conditional on a hospitalization, what's the probability to die after a hospitalization? So the incidence of hospitalizations are shown in blue and the case fertility rates, so the probability to die after hospitalization, are shown in green. So we see a gradient, a strong gradient in both factors underlying mortality rates. But if anything, we see a stronger gradient in the green one, especially when we express this in relative terms. So a lot could be underlying this. People may go to the hospital if they come from lower income household with worse conditions, or people may get worse treatment once they enter the hospitals, okay? And so the idea is that we can cut these data in very different ways, and we are going to try to do that to try to shed light on what is underlying this. Let me give you one example of a way that we've been doing this following what people have done in this literature. And this is focusing not on all hospitalizations, but on unanticipated hospitalizations. These are hospitalizations that are preceded for an individual by 3 years without any significant hospital expenditures. Okay, so what we see in this graph is once individuals are hospitalized, then whether you're from a low income background or a high income background, the difference in hospital expenditures is not that large, okay? And it remains similar as in the years that follows as well, okay? If we look at the differences in mortality rates, however, they're huge. The mortality rates are twice as high for people that have below median income compared to people that have above median income, okay? So this again could be driven by different things. It could be that even though people haven't had any hospitalizations before the hospitalization that we observe, that people with a low income background come into the hospital with worse conditions. But if that is the explanation, it is very puzzling why the hospital expenditures are so similar for people that have much worse conditions. Another underlying factor could be that people with a lower income background coming into the hospital are more frail. That's a term that people are using in the medical literature. But if that is the explanation, then it's also somehow surprising why they're not receiving different expenditures. But it may also emphasize that it's not just what's happening in the hospital, but that's also what is happening in the after hospitalization care that may be very important to try to close the differences in mortality across these two income groups. Okay. So this is ongoing work that we're doing. There's lots of information here that we could try to, that we have access to and that we can try to use to shed light on these differences. So how am I doing on time? Should I close here?
So Johannes, you've been very kind. I think you can go on because let me just say, the way to ask questions in this thing is not by putting your hand up, it's by typing it in the Q&A, right? So since I don't have any questions in the Q&A that haven't been answered, I'm going to allow Johannes to go on with his second illustration.
Okay, so let me spend 3 minutes on my second illustration. So this is a very different setting, again in the Netherlands, but this is health insurance settings, health insurance choices.
So in the Netherlands, everyone is subject to a compulsory deductible on their health expenditures, meaning that if their expenditures fall below this deductible, they have to pay everything out of pockets. All expenditures above this deductible are fully covered. Individuals now have the option to increase this deductible by 500 euros. If they increase this deductible by 500 euros, they reduce the health insurance premium that they have to pay by 250 euros. We can predict for every individual in the Netherlands, given all the health information we have on the individuals, what is the probability that your costs will be low? And if the probability of your costs are sufficiently low, it would be optimal for you to take this higher deductible and get the premium reduction. Okay, given the numbers that I told you, 500 euros of deductible, 250 euros of premium reduction, the threshold when you're trying to minimize expected expenditures would be at 50%. So you should shift from taking up the extra deductible right at this threshold. So that's the dashed line, that's the optimal line. What we see in terms of observed deductible take up, we see that it's much, much lower than that. So people are making bad decisions here on average, which is very much driven by a default effect rather than differences by preferences. Refer to the paper if you want more detail on that. So this now we can link to all the socioeconomic information we have on the individuals and see like what is driving the fact that people are not making better choices on this. And education, people's educational background or their human capital, if you want, is a key driver of the quality of the choices that individuals make. So I'm showing you the same gradients of people's take-up as a function of the predicted probability of having low health costs, but now by different degrees. And we see that people who have done further studies are more than three times as likely to take up this higher deductible, making a better choice than people who are high school dropouts. So we can also show this by field of education. For instance, statisticians are making much better decisions than philosophers and are making much better decisions on average, for instance, compared to people working in health and hair and beauty services or people working in security. And we also have these kind of information on professional sector, again, showing that people work in business services or in insurance and health insurance make much better decisions. Of course, all of these things are very correlated. And one thing we're doing in this paper as well is rank people based on what the qualities of the decisions that they're making, and then show what the average characteristics are, for instance, from the very best to the very worst decision makers. And comparing them based, for instance, on their education and education field confirms just what I've told you before. But if you look at income differences and wealth differences for people in the top of the quality of decision makers versus the bottom, you're seeing huge differences here. And we're finding, for instance, that peer effects are important as well. So all of this suddenly sheds new light on the idea of whether we should offer choice in a health insurance market like in the Netherlands. So this is a focus on a very specific choice, which is health insurance choices. And I think this research design has a lot of internal validity. So now going back to the gradients that I showed you before, there is quite a bit of work to do. But if people are making such different choices or are subject to different quality of choices in this context, we're worried that the same may be going on when people are thinking about investing in healthy behaviors, in healthy diets, and so on. And while we know that on average, this contributes to the inequalities that we see, often there is a debate on to what extent is this preferences or something else. And here we're trying to argue that a lot of this could also be driven by behavioral biases that are underlying people's choices. So let me conclude with that. And let me just say that what we've tried to show here in these four presentations is how new data allows to really measure new dimensions of inequality, how it allows to shed hopefully new light on mechanisms. And then the final theme of what we want to do as well, that my colleagues have highlighted a lot, is what then the policy implications are of these new insights that we're getting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Johannes. And thank you to Camille and Javier and Daniel as well. Those are great presentations. Now we do have a number of questions. Quite a number that have come in on Camille's first presentation. But before I ask Camille a couple of specific questions, let me just put one out for all of you that actually was something I wanted to ask about myself, but Guodong Zhu has asked it very nicely. And I'd like all of you to maybe comment on that at the end. So I'll read it now and then I'll ask some questions to Camille. So Guodong Zhu asks, some scholars foresee that with the availability of big data and huge computing power, inequality between scholars will rise dramatically. Prestigious scholars find it easier to get big data than junior scholars. How do you think about, what do you think about that opinion? Do you think big data will stagnate the academia? And how should we juniors deal with that? So that's a question for everyone. Big data is hugely powerful, but perhaps harder to get, creates an inequality between scholars. Then let me ask, if I may, questions for Camille. I'll group maybe three of them. Camille, is that okay?
Yeah, but I think we might as well start with this very important question right away, no? Why don't we do that?
Go ahead then.
So yeah, I think it's a very important concern, and I think your prediction is unfortunately probably going in the right direction. Like a subtle nuance that I want to add to this, and others can come into as well. Like, there is a little bit of an inequality that has like changed for the better as a consequence. So I think in economics research, like often, like the quality of research is driven by the quality of the data. And I think Europe has been lagging behind on that relative to the US. And you see that a lot of research has been very much US focused. But I think the European like countries are kind of like closing the gap by having this fantastic administrative data available. So the number of papers that have been done on Danish, on Swedish, on Norwegian, and or on Dutch data, for instance, like helps us like closing that gap a little bit. But I told you that like this is like a nuance on like the big concern that you're expressing.
But I would add something relatively important as well, which is like, so clearly.
Can you get closer to the mic, please?
Sorry. Let me add something important, which is that, yeah, clearly with big data, some of it is proprietary and some of it is not. It's public data, it's collected by administration. And it's in some sense the role of the statistical agency, of the public agency, to disseminate this information, to consolidate it in a way that makes it available to everyone. And I think in that respect, a lot of big statistical agencies in Europe, but even in the US, are doing this in the right way and are, to the contrary, providing access to great granular data to a very large area of researcher, and that is definitely going in the right direction. But then there is also all the proprietary data, and that is definitely an issue. Who gets access to this and so on and so forth is definitely not equal. On the use of the data, yes, we're not gonna lie. Big data requires intensive data work. And more established researchers with bigger teams are therefore able to write bigger benefits from the use of this data than, you know, scholars who have smaller teams, who only have themselves and so on and so forth. So there is definitely also in that direction an element of potential increase in inequality. And this is for us all to kind of make sure that we mitigate these dangers.
Thanks.
I got one small fact, and maybe we should talk about some other questions. So, I mean, I think it's also true that in the current environment that we're in, there is a big reward to being entrepreneurial. The LSE has had a number of PhD students who went to their home countries, got the statistical agencies of those countries to start opening up and sharing data. And also, you know, in the United States, if you know, this concern would have been much worse if you had asked your question 10 years ago. I mean, in the early days of the U.S. tax data being opened up to researchers, I think there were three people who had access to it, and they were all at Harvard, MIT, Berkeley. And now there's, I think there's over 100 researchers who are in some way, you know, able to work with that type of data. And part of that's due to the work of a lot of people at the IRS and a lot of researchers in trying to expand access to that data. So I think we should be absolutely be mindful of that concern and try and do what we can and to expand access. And if we do that, I might think there is some hope for the future here.
Thanks, Daniel. Javier, did anything from you on this or so?
Maybe just adding that indeed, I think we do have a role to play to encourage broader access. So some of what we do actually uses firm data, bank data or scanner data, and we can actually very concretely encourage the data providers to make access broader for other researchers. That's one. And then the other is to sometimes give access to public statistics, which can be used in other research projects. So that's diffusion of sort of the outputs at a granular level that can be used in other research projects. So I think, the way the question was asked is saying that perhaps we have sort of new tools to create knowledge today, which is big data, but there might be slower diffusion than in the past. It could be, but I'm not so sure. As Daniel said, there are opportunities for entrepreneurial students, and there's also, in a way, a responsibility for those who have the data to push things towards faster diffusion.
Great. Thanks a lot, Xavier. Thanks, everyone. So now I have two questions. People vote. So I'm now getting the most voted questions. And I have two for Camille here. One from Mary Alice Doyle, who's a PhD student at LSE. Thanks for a very interesting presentation. Are you able to see any correlation in the cross-country differences in the child penalty and national parental leave policies, and or differences in child penalty based on whether the mother stays employed or not? I'm surprised the penalty is so high in Denmark since they have quite generous parental leave. Can I do the other one, or do you want to answer that and then I ask?
Oh, I will answer that one right away. I think this is, of course, a great question that has been really also at the heart of our research agenda, understanding to what extent policies can mitigate these child penalties. So I think what's really important, and that relates to the second part of the question, is that the child penalty that shows you encompasses everything. This is the earnings responses to the arrival of the first kid. So that means the employment effect, whether you choose to work or not, how many hours you choose to work, and also the wage rate effects. So conditional on staying employed, what is the effect on your wage rate? It turns out that the overall effect that we're seeing on earnings is really, can be decomposed into an effect on all these three dimensions that is roughly equal. You have quite some response at the extensive margin, some women stop to work. For those who stay in work, a lot of them have a decrease in their number of hours, they move to part-time. And even if they continue to work and work actively, you also have an effect on the wage rate because of a bunch of changes in the type of work that women do and no change for men. So clearly there is really this effect on these three dimensions. So then what we see with parental leave policies, for instance, is that surprisingly they have no effect in the long run on the child penalty, but they have, of course, effects on the short run, because if you give more parental leave, women are going to take it, okay? And that means that in general, they're going to stay out of the labor force longer by taking these parental leaves out. So what we've done in Austria is to compute the effect of all the changes in family policies, including parental leave, but also childcare, over a period of 60 years. And what we found is that eventually, because all these policies do not have much of an effect on the long run of the child penalty, and this is what matters really for the cross-section of gender inequality, public policies so far have been relatively unhelpful in decreasing gender inequality. That doesn't mean that they are not important, but that means that if we place all our hope that policies, by changing at the margin the incentives of women relative to men, are going to essentially change the big specialization generals that we're seeing in the data, that hope is misplaced.
Okay, thank you very much. So for the sake of variety, let me do one for Johannes now, who's next to you, and then we'll come back to you in a bit. So from David Piachot, Johannes. Links between income and mortality are interesting. But income is also correlated with environmental quality and health service quality. Do the new data sources make it possible to distinguish how far income is a real factor of itself, or is it largely a proxy for other factors?
So yeah, it's a great question. So I think here it's the power of the administrative data that is very important. So all of these things are extremely correlated. So if you don't have enough observations, it's hard to see what is driving what. But if you have enough observations, then even conditional on income, you will have a lot of variation in these other factors that you're mentioning. And that allows you to tease out what the role is of these other factors. And this is kind of exactly what we were doing, but I didn't do justice to our findings in my last minute of my presentation. But when I said that education is really the predominant factor, like this is controlling for differences in income as well. Of course, education and income are extremely correlated, but we see that controlling for income, differences in education are so much more important for these choices that people are making than the opposite, controlling for education. What are the differences in income saying about people's difference in this in the choices that they're making? So this is exactly like what we can get at with the data.
Thanks, Johannes. I can see that Camille is answering some other question on the chat, but let me read you one, Camille, from your multitasking there. Well, question from Berkay Özkan from Social Policy. It's a long question, so let me read it on to you. So thanks for the great presentation to all presenters. For Camille, I need a bit more clarification about how endogenous fertility decisions are treated in his graphs. Golden and many sociologists call them anticipation effects. So if child costs incur long before childbirth, you see a lot of delay in childbirth age, which might have reduced the pre-childbirth investment differences while keeping post-child investment constant. But this too varies depending on where the income distribution specific women are located, right? So the question is, isn't this the main source of variation across country? Isn't this where the main source of variation across countries is found? This is a second part, but I think that's
I can respond on that one. So this is an excellent question. And indeed, what's really important to understand in these graph that I showed you of the child penalties is that what we're identifying in terms of the effect of children really comes from the fact that we can compare women who are at the same age, but some have had kids earlier and some have had kids a little bit later. And to the extent that you believe that the precise timing of the arrival of the kid is somewhat exogenous, then you can identify the effect of the arrival of kids on the outcomes of women and that of men. So clearly, one key question is, to what extent can we really believe that women who have kids 1 year earlier versus 1 year later are comparable? And for that, basically, we can do a lot of things to assuage the concerns that we are really capturing some non-random differences between women. Clearly, if you just take women who have kids very late versus women who have kids very early, they are very different. But to the extent that you compare women who have kids at age 24 versus 25, then the precise timing here is much more exogenous. But that being said, and coming back to the key question, which was this idea that, you know, there are some anticipation effects. What's really surprising is that even if you take women with high-flying careers, they will indeed tend to have kids later, but they still bear a very large penalties, which is roughly similar in size to the penalty that you see for women who have kids earlier. So clearly there is a sense by which it cannot be just a question of some women want to have kids later to minimize the penalties and some women want to have a big penalty and they are willing to have kids earlier. But that brings me back though to an important thing that we see in the cross section. So when I showed you these maps of countries, penalties are extremely large in countries such as Germany, Austria, Switzerland, countries that are extremely gender conservative. And clearly in these countries, what we also see is that the overall fertility decreases. So clearly when you know ex ante that you're gonna face huge penalties from having children, your desire to have a huge number of children decreases among women in the past 20, 30 years.
Great. Thank you so much. On that note, I think we'll end with my thanking the four of you, Johannes, Camille, Javier, Daniel, very much. Excellent presentations. I think you guys did a wonderful job of bringing very different things, gender inequality, health inequality, taxation and tax evasion, differences in inflation rates, under this common theme of what new data can provide. So very, very nice. Thanks a lot. And for people who came in the audience, thanks as well. And please see the website of the public economics inequality theme is on the chat. So thanks very much again, and good evening to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.